they need to demand nature-based solutions that can address the triple threats of climate change, biodiversity loss, and food security, end quote.
Aperture.
A visit to Iran yields a stunning variety of culinary delights. There's a vast spectrum of foods flourishing for centuries and evolving since Achaemenid times. Persian cooking incorporates many flavors into its uniquely delicious food traditions. A taste of Persia's food can be identified by its sumptuous rice dishes, its intriguing and delicate flavors, and its combination of herbs, spice, fruit, and nuts. And one integral component to Persian cuisine is the use of saffron, the world's most expensive spice, which gives Iranian food its distinct flavor and aroma and golden hue. I'm Zarin Shajeri, and this is Aperture. Many coveted ingredients are native to Iran, including pistachios, almonds, walnuts, pomegranates, grapes, and perhaps most notably, saffron. Iran has a variable climate with four distinct seasons. The ancient Persians transformed vast stretches of arid land into fertile oases through underground aquifers that drew melted snow water into the desert. And thus, a bright, sensuous, fruit and herb-filled cuisine was born. This week on Aperture, we will follow Javad Gharayi as he explores the amazing deserts of South Khorasan province and visits a charming little village where saffron, the world's most highly prized spice, is grown. Don't miss the first part.
This time, I leave the cold winter weather in the capital city for the beautiful desert flower farms. My destination is the outskirts of South Khorasan province, an area famous for its saffron, Iran's prized red gold. Iran is one of the most mountainous countries in the world, covered by rugged mountain ranges and deserts. 61% of the country has a dry climate. Deserts cover a combined area of around 34 million hectares, scattered among 18 of its provinces. That means around 30% of the country is made up of vast deserts featuring many mountains, salt pans, and sand dunes. Deserts across the world share almost the same features. Little precipitation, intense evaporation of water due to the scorching sun, smothering heat, dry air, great temperature fluctuations, poor vegetation, and a dearth of adequate organic compounds in the soil. However, despite the hostile climate of the deserts of Iran, life is in progress on their margins. I'm Javad Gharayi. I'm an Iran trotter, and I'm taking you on a journey to the most pristine areas of my beloved country and showing you their many beauties. Before visiting the saffron grove, I decide to take a look around at the desert surroundings on the outskirts of South Khorasan province. To that end, I begin my journey with Helwan Desert, located within 90 kilometers of Tabas, a city in and the capital of Tabas County, in the northwest of South Khorasan. Because of its distance from the urban areas, the natural beauties of deserts are not known to humans as much as they should. If you want to venture out into the desert in order to admire its matchless beauties, you'd have to choose the right season and the right time of day. From a distance, deserts and the wilderness don't seem all that beautiful. Once you have set foot in them, you feel as if you've stepped into a veritable heaven. But a different kind of heaven. You don't see forests with tall trees, grass, or running water. All you can see is streams with very salty water, single salt cedars and saxoles, scattered shrubs and bushes in the landscape, camels and other species unique to this hot and dry climate. It's very beautiful and peaceful here, but that's not always the case. Within minutes, this whole area can turn into an ominously stormy ocean. Ferocious storms of sand and dust that have buried many a caravan and traveler over the course of centuries. In the not-too-distant past, some of Iran's deserts were inhabited by people living in this climate. But thanks to global warming and decreased precipitation that led to drinking water wells drying and parts of the vegetation dying, the people living in such areas were forced to leave their little villages for a better place. Today, those villages lay in ruins on their original locations. Ruins that now serve as shelters for the camel herders against the blazing sun. But these homes of yesterday are still as beautiful as ever. Deserts around the world are expanding by the year. Desert expansion or desertification is a result of global warming, the growth in the human population, unplanned agriculture and excessive firewood collection, depletion of subterranean water resources, industrial contaminants and excessive use of fossil fuels, overgrazing by livestock, and the change in the use of agricultural land. This conversion of habitable and fertile land to uninhabitable desert can happen naturally due to a drought, or can be caused by human activities. Activities that have disturbed the balance of nature on planet Earth. Iran accounts for more than 2% of the world's drought. It's also home to more than 8% of the deserts and arid lands that contain no vegetation, and that is considered a big number. But in the fringes of this same hot and dry desert, meaning the one in South Khorasan, there are mountains that supply the rivers and qanats in this area with drinking water. Streams that could be regarded as the natural wonders of this otherwise parched region. Taht-e-Arus, or the Bride's Throne, near the village of Izmiran on the Tabas-Mashhad Road, is a befitting name for this stream. The flowing water reminds me of the celebrations held by people in the old times upon the discovery of clean, fresh water in a hot and dry region. Only those born and bred in a dry climate with limited resources of fresh water appreciate its true value. People who have endured thirst, have felt the baking heat from the sun on their skin, and may have seen rain coming down from the skies over their heads only once a year. The people of Esmiran fit that profile perfectly. God has bestowed upon them fresh water in a stream gushing out of the dry desert mountains around Tebas. And the people here have utmost appreciation for this most precious of God's blessings in the heart of the natural world. In the distant past, the people of Esmiran lived in dwellings carved into mountain wall. With the tools they had, they would dig deep vertical and horizontal holes into the side of the mountains. In them, they'd carve out rooms where they'd live. In the past, these hand-carved chambers were referred to as looms. Desert people are very smart. Using the water from the stream and the fertile soil here, they've been farming rice for generations. Today, the rice produced in Esmiran is among the best in the country. Who would believe there are paddy fields in the middle of a desert and among these mountains? Everybody thinks rice is only grown in the north of Iran. But where does the stream go on this dry land? After irrigating the paddy fields of Esmiran, does it sink into the arid terrain in the areas surrounding the rice farms? That can't be the case, because to the desert dwellers, fresh water is worth more than diamonds. The locals in this area have spoken to me of a formidable yet beautiful canyon and helped me see the rest of the course that the water from Tahtiaru spring takes. The name of that canyon is Kala Jinni, the Canal of Jinns, shaped by water movement and erosion over centuries. I'm going to step into a canyon where the water from Tahtiaru's spring is flowing, but the volume of the water is not large enough to make it to the end of this very long course without going to waste. I'm curious to know how that water continues on its path in the dry land and where it eventually gets to. It's simply beautiful. As I said, the name of the awe-inspiring canyon is Kala Jinni. On its bottom, water from the Tahtiaru spring of Tabaz is moving as we speak. Most of the way, the water flows between the two walls of this canyon, just like it does in Aghanat, and springs out of the underground near Tabaz. It's one of the most beautiful sights to see around the city of Tabaz in South Khorasan province. The Canal of Jinns. That's a scary name. Kala Jinni was shaped so beautifully by water movements, such as seasonal rain-induced floodwaters over thousands or millions of years. It kind of looks like the Grand Canyon in the U.S., though it doesn't share the same depth. It really is stunning. After a long walk in the mountains, I arrive at the upper end of the canyon. From up here, it's a spectacular deep gorge. I explore the canyon as much as I can, and as long as there is nothing to threaten my life. But as I walk the length of it, water from Tahtiaru spring is nowhere to be found most of the way. The locals have already given me valuable information about that, but to see everything firsthand, I have to walk down to the bottom of the valley, and I do so with gusto and caution. One of the things that renders Kala Jinni even more remarkable is its pristineness. Not many nature travelers come here, and fortunately those who do don't leave behind any kind of waste or garbage. And that has turned this canyon into one of the most must-see natural sights in the Tabaz area. There are ghanats here. In some places, water has pushed its way out, but there are still other ghanats inside walls that continue all the way to the villages of Tabaz. And this water originates from the Tahtiaru spring in Esmiran province. It's the same water that's come all the way here and has welled out. In the absence of plumbing in the past, they would channel fresh water from one village to another, or from the mountains to their villages and farms by means of a kanat system, and they did it to prevent the water from going to waste. This one here is one of those kanats. Out on the bottom of the canyon, the water would sink into the ground. So they channeled the water downhill through a series of gently sloping tunnels along several kilometers to the places where it was needed for irrigation and domestic use. Although new kanats are seldom built today, many old ones are still used in Iran and have until recently served as one of the main reasons behind the continuation of life in areas with hot and dry climates. New technology has in recent years led to a rapid depletion of the underground water reservoirs. But we can still think of reviving the kanat water supply system, take advantage of this millennia-old experience for agricultural purposes in Iran, and do something to make it happen. I knew very well that the rainfall in the eastern regions of the country is less than half the rain that falls in the western regions. Therefore, water is much more valuable in this part of the country. The people living in these parts have always been thinking of innovative ways of harnessing water and managing its resources. Digging kanats and channeling underground water onto the surface was very common in Iran. They didn't cost much, and they were very efficient. Kanats offered several advantages. Firstly, they prevent the sun from shining directly at the water and making it evaporate. Secondly, moving inside the mountains, not much of the water is absorbed by the bedding walls of the channel. And thirdly, the water is immune to any and all kinds of contamination and flows to its destination clean and cool. What's certain is that humans wouldn't have been able to survive in the desert areas if they hadn't built the kanats. Almost all researchers believe that the world's first kanats were built in areas under Iran's cultural influence. No one knows for sure why the ancient dwellers of this region named this gorge the Kali Jinni. But apparently, some of them believe this canyon was haunted by jinns or ghosts. There were others who believed the idea of digging holes and caves into the mountainside for safety was something that even ghosts wouldn't have been able to come up with. Or maybe the reason why this canyon was named the Canal of Jinns was the roaring seasonal floodwaters that swept along this canyon and still do today. Whatever the name, it must have been chosen for a reason. It defies belief that there is so much water in the Kali Jinni Canyon. To the people of southern Khorasan province, each drop of this water is worth as much as a kilo of saffron, and this canyon has a lot of it. It looks like someone has chiseled away at the rocks. The only sound you can hear in the mountains is that of the water rippling along the kanats. Eventually, I get to a point in the canyon where the ancient dwellers of this land redirected the water from the surface to a canal inside the mountain. This is where the water is redirected underground. It was the brainchild of folks who lived here in the distant past, and that beautiful kanat dug inside the wall of the canyon carries this water to the villages lying on the outskirts of Tabas. The locals have told me different things about the cavities and man-made holes inside the Kali Jinni. Apparently, no one has accurate information on the age of those cave-like shelters. But tales of how they came to be have been passed down from one generation to another. I spend hours scouring the canyon for those man-made tunnels, and I finally find them. It is hard to believe how these tunnels were hand-carved at this height. Niches that acted as footholds to help them climb some 5 or 6 meters to get to the chambers above, where they are likely to have lived, and that was where they felt safe. It's still not clear why these tunnels, these wells, and these chambers were dug into the walls of this canyon, and at this height, by the people in the past. but many believe they actually lived here. This was the perfect place for people to take shelter in and survive the stifling heat of the Tabas region. And there are many others who believe this was a place where the village dwellers around here, who wanted to steer clear of the brigands and looters, would transfer all their valuable belongings. They themselves would hide here too, along with their belongings, and wait for the looters to leave the area. Of course, there are also others who are of the opinion that these tunnels were just the right place for the people of that time to come to and worship their gods. That in fact, they considered this place as their place of worship. They call it the Canal of Jinns for a reason. It can get really scary in some parts. And it's obvious that torrential floodwaters have shaped this valley like this over the years. In fact, what those floodwaters did was wash away the dirt and stones on their path. Of course, it might have taken millions of years for this canyon to take on the shape it has today. It's frightening to be here and walking on the bottom flanked by tall walls. It looks endless to me. I've been walking these smaller gorges near Kalajini for hours, but it looks like there is no end in sight. I haven't been able to get to the other end of any of them. The deeper you go inside, you realize you have more to go. This is a completely virgin valley with no traces whatsoever of human activity in it. Usually, garbage is the first sign of human presence in the natural world. It's clear to me that only people who feel responsible to nature have been to this area before. That is because there is no trash on the ground and no writings on the walls. That has made my trip into the heart of the canyon ever more worthwhile and helped me appreciate its magnificence more intensely. My visit to the Kalajini Canyon has come to an end. I got to see beautiful sights in the canyon from different angles. The canyon has a scary name, but that didn't change my mind about traveling right into it and exploring it. I continue my trek in the desert, this time to see the desert flower, commonly known as the saffron crocus. That means an approximately 200-kilometer walking distance from the Kalajini Canyon. On my way there, the imposing ruins of an ancient building grab my attention. They are the remains of a desolate village by the name of Dihuk. Iranian deserts always have wonderful surprises for travelers, and this beautiful ancient village is one of them. What really tugs at my heartstrings, though, is that the villagers have abandoned these buildings with their unique architecture for brick-and-mortar homes. It saddens me to see traditional Iranian architecture consigned to oblivion by my fellow Iranians in cities and villages. Today, Iranian architecture that encompasses life and vitality, art and aesthetic beauties, and love and positive energy is being replaced by ghastly steel and mortar structures. Architecture that's alien to the Persian culture. Architecture that bears no signs of the ancient Persian culture and doesn't include the freshness, the gardens, the water pools, and other natural features characteristic of traditional Persian architecture. Such homes do not belong in our country, and I wish they had never been built. In my opinion, this ancient village is one of the most beautiful villages I've ever seen in this area. The people here, I mean the people who used to live here, call this village Ancient Dihuk. Now, they live in a small township by the same name, built around 20 to 25 years ago. It was built after the earthquake in the year 1978. So now they call this place Old Dihuk, which, as I say, is one of the most beautiful villages on the margins of the Lut Desert.
This is IRIB English Radio.
IRIB English Radio, with you every single moment.
In the limelight.
The Myanmar's armed forces, known as the Tatmadaw, are notorious for committing rights abuses with impunity, most notably following a brutal 2017 crackdown on Rakhine State's mostly Muslim Rohingya minority that sent 740,000 fleeing across the border to Bangladesh. A United Nations Independent International Fact-Finding Mission stated in a September 2019 report that Myanmar was failing in its obligation to prevent, investigate or enact effective legislation criminalizing and punishing genocide in relation to its treatment of the Rohingya Muslim minority. We now present you an article written jointly by Emily Fishbein and Kyo Hassan Hliang under the heading In Myanmar's Rakhine, Families of the Disappeared Seek Answers. The article has been taken from the AlJazeera.com website. Please stay with us for more of Emily Fishbein and Kyo Hassan Hliang's article. One evening, as Mona Wei and her family were having dinner, soldiers from Myanmar's armed forces, known as the Tatmadaw, came to her house and asked for her husband. According to her account, they blindfolded him, took out their guns and beat him in front of her. Mona Wei, an ethnic Arakanese from Myanmar's westernmost Rakhine State, who prefers not to reveal her real identity for fear of reprisals, said, "At the time, I could only cry," she added. "I feared they would shoot me, so I held my tongue. I felt like they were the most brutal people in the world." It was 16th of March 2020, and the last time she saw her husband. He's among 18 people from the neighboring villages of Tinmatit and Tinmagi in Rakhine State's northern Kyoktau township, who were arrested in March of 2020 and have not been seen ever since. Their families' relentless search for information has been met with silence, rejection and threats. 10 months later, they're still looking for answers and they're looking for justice. Three witnesses, whose testimonies align with those published by other media, told Al Jazeera that on 13th of March and 16th of March, uniformed soldiers wearing the badge of the Tatmadaw's Light Infantry Division No. 55 went door-to-door arresting dozens of men. It's suspected of having ties to the Arakan Army, an ethnic group seeking autonomy. Some of those arrested were released the same day, but 18 individuals were not released. The missing include a 16-year-old teenage boy, three people over the age of 65, and one person who is deaf. Al Jazeera has used pseudonyms for the three witnesses to protect them from possible reprisals. On 18th of March 2020, four bodies were seen floating in the Kaladan River near the villages. One of the bodies was identified by family members as among the missing villagers. The family told local media that soldiers shot at them when they approached the body floating in the river, which the US government-funded broadcaster Radio Free Asia reported was riddled with bullet holes. The three other bodies were never identified. All of the missing are Arakanese, also called Rakhine, a predominantly Buddhist ethnic group thought to make up the majority in the state. Frustrated with political marginalization and perceived domination under Myanmar's ethnic Bamar majority, increasing numbers of Arakanese have in recent years joined the Arakan army to fight for their legal rights, which were violated in their country. Since conflict escalated in late 2018, nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed or seriously injured in violence, including indiscriminate air raids, gunfire and landmines, and more than 230,000 have fled their homes. The arrests in Tinmagi and Tinmatit villages occurred following 2 weeks of intense clashes near the villages. Tunhala, who was among those arrested and released, said, "The Tatmadaw soldiers went house to house calling the men." He added, "I don't know why we were arrested by the Tatmadaw. At the time, the soldiers didn't give any reason. 10 people were tied and beaten with guns in front of me. Days later, the villagers fled." Zorwin, a local advocate helping the families of the missing to seek justice, told Al Jazeera that 3 elderly men stayed in Tinmagi village to watch over the monastery and have also not been seen ever since. Shortly after the villagers were deserted, the houses were razed. Villagers blamed the Tatmadaw soldiers, which have denied responsibility. Myanmar's police forces are under the control of the Ministry of Home Affairs, which itself is under the jurisdiction of the Tatmadaw. On 23rd of March, a group of family members of the missing, now scattered in different displacement camps, filed a case regarding the disappearances with township police. Letters were also sent to the Myanmar National Human Rights Commission and the offices of the Commander-in-Chief, President, and State Councillor, calling for an investigation into the disappearances. No updates came until June of 2020, when a Tatmadaw spokesperson denied anyone had been arrested in the 2 villages. 5 more months of silence followed. On 27th of November, the Tatmadaw spokesperson announced that the families could open a case at the relevant police station, and that if the police reported any suspicious information, the Tatmadaw would decide whether to conduct its own investigation. The families returned to the township police station on 8th of December, but Man Away told Al Jazeera the police officers on duty warned them against opening the case. She said, "Regarding the initial case, the police told us their paperwork disappeared," adding, "Then they threatened us several times that we could be detained and sent to jail." So Win, who accompanied the villagers to the police station, noted, "They said this case doesn't concern them and we should go to the Tatmadaw station to inquire," adding, "When we replied that the police had a responsibility to seek justice, they said they could immediately detain us and send us to jail." The Myanmar National Human Rights Commission, which has faced criticism for not intervening in other high-profile cases, has also done little to support the Tinmar villagers. Kyokta Township legislator Tun Win, who submitted the request to investigate the case, told Al Jazeera the commission responded in November that the Tinmar villagers were not detained by the Tatmadaw. Its chairperson told local media on December 30th that the pandemic prevented an on-site investigation and that the commission had closed the case after inquiring with the defense ministry, which denied that the Tatmadaw had any involvement. A police investigation finally began on 29th of December, when district police in the nearby town of Murukyu called the villagers in for questioning. Man Wei stayed behind out of fear. She said, "I feel like my children and we are not safe since my husband disappeared. I'm really worried we could be attacked because we filed charges." According to Radio Free Asia, the police took statements from 15 people. The next day, the Tatmadaw spokesperson stated that concerned individuals could file reports and present credible evidence with the local military division office or regional military commanders. Al Jazeera's calls to the Tatmadaw spokesperson, township and district police stations, Myanmar's National Human Rights Commission, and Rakhine State government spokesperson all went unanswered. Media are only allowed to report from Rakhine with permission and official escort, and the government has restricted mobile internet services across conflict-affected townships, including the township of Kyukto, since June of 2019. Local lawyer Zulwin told Al Jazeera he was frustrated by an apparent lack of political will to address the case. He said, "All authorities have to take responsibility," he added. "Those in power need to know the situation, follow human rights standards, and seek justice." The Tatmadaw is notorious for committing human rights abuses with impunity, most notably following a brutal 2017 crackdown on Rakhine State's mostly Muslim Rohingya minority that sent 740,000 people fleeing into neighboring Bangladesh. A United Nations Independent International Fact-Finding Mission stated in a September 2019 report that Myanmar was failing in its obligation to prevent, investigate, or enact effective legislation criminalizing and punishing genocide in relation to its treatment of the Rohingya Muslim minority. The fact-finding mission also, in an August 2018 report, identified enforced disappearances among crimes against humanity committed in Kachin, Rakhine State, and Shan states, for which Myanmar's top military generals must be investigated and prosecuted. The Tin Ma villagers' cases are not the only enforced disappearances to have occurred in Rakhine State since the report was released. According to a tally by the Rakhine-based development media group, between January and June of 2020, at least 30 civilians disappeared in the state of Rakhine after being arrested by the Tatmadaw. As of October, Radio Free Asia counted 32 more who have died after being taken into Tatmadaw custody from the start of 2019 to October 12th of 2020. In April of 2020, UN human rights expert Yang Yi Li said accountability was critical to ending the crackdown by the Tatmadaw. She said in a statement, "Having faced no accountability, the Tatmadaw soldiers continue to operate with impunity," adding, "They are now targeting all civilians in the conflict area. Their crimes must be investigated in accordance with international standards, with perpetrators being held accountable." Miu Miat Hien, the chair of the Arakan Lawyers Council, which is providing legal aid to the families of the missing Tin Ma villagers, also emphasized the importance of accountability. He said, "It isn't acceptable just to say the villagers are missing because several people saw the Tatmadaw soldiers detain them." He added, "Conflict actors need to build trust beyond just talking about the national peace process." Tun Win, the Kyukto Township legislator, emphasizes the urgency of achieving justice for the Tin Ma villagers and others affected by human rights abuses in the state of Rakhine. He said, "If the perpetrators of these crimes have impunity, it will be difficult to achieve sustainable justice." Man Wei said she lies sleepless at night, worrying about her husband and fearing for her and her children's safety and survival. "They were unable to harvest their paddy fields this season and are living on 15,000 kyats, or roughly $11 a month, in food aid." Man Wei wants to go home but still fears that the Tatmadaw soldiers stationed near her village. She said, "As long as they're staying there, we won't be safe.
Around the world with reporters.
Travel agents in 13 different countries should get ready for a rush of customers. The United States has finally lifted its shockingly xenophobic and unprecedented travel ban. Iran was one of six other Muslim-majority nations which were primarily targeted, which caused ex-President Donald Trump's executive order to become called the Muslim travel ban, informally and infamously. New President Joe Biden ended the ban on his first day in office. The bigotry lasted 4 years, and the damage to American citizens, countless non-Americans, and America's image cannot be overestimated.
The real shame in this is not simply turning our back on, America's tradition of not judging people on the basis of their religion or our constitutional prohibition against that. But what's really, troubling about this is that we have gone through this process where family members have not been able to be together with loved ones.
Husbands and wives have been kept apart for years. Grandparents passed away without seeing their newborn grandchildren. Weddings, graduations, birthdays, funerals, jobs, business deals, educational exchanges. The accumulation of grief and difficulty caused by the Islamophobic ban is appalling. In many ways, the ban backfired because it emphatically demonstrated the scope and reach of state-sponsored Islamophobia, something which had been routinely denied by the right and the left, not only in the United States, but across the West.
It's really going to require that we go through the hard work of actually implementing policies, not just in travel, but in other ways that fight against Islamophobia, because we know that it has been a feature in our society, certainly for the last 30 years, but even long before that.
The ban led to doctor shortages in a United States which would soon be unable to handle the coronavirus pandemic. It also put a pause on the so-called brain drain, which allows America to stay near the forefront of science and technology. Trump's dehumanizing of Muslims followed years of scapegoating in order to rationalize the wars across the Muslim world started by Trump's predecessors, George W. Bush and Barack Obama. Perhaps above all, the ban showed that in the American system, it is still possible to codify racism into law. The Supreme Court reversed a series of lower court decisions which allowed the ban to go into effect. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Slim hopes of progress towards peace in Yemen were swiftly dashed this month as former US President Donald Trump designated Yemen's Houthi Ansarullah movement as a foreign terrorist organization before he left office. A move widely condemned as deeply damaging to the peace process and pushing the country towards a possible new famine. Amid fears for Yemen's future, I secured an exclusive interview with the foreign minister of the Ansarullah-led government in Sana'a for a response to these disturbing developments.
The U.S. is not an international organization or some kind of an institution that has the right to designate someone as terrorist or not terrorist. The U.S. should always be concerned about its affairs, not trying to be the guardian of the whole world.
The foreign minister explained that he felt the U.S. decision was silly and that Trump was probably paid into making the choice.
I think the Trump administration decision was something paid for, and you will see it in the near future. It's something paid for to say certain things or to take some actions So again, from our side, we are not concerned about that, and we will not deal with it.
I asked the foreign minister whether Yemen would consider a military response. He warned that if the peace process totally fails, Yemen is strong enough to fight back.
If such peace fails, we are ready for all circumstances, and our choices are wide open. And by the way, we can affect and do what we want. We are so strong to the point that we can change the whole scenario, but we will not do it for the sake of the Yemeni people.
The foreign minister also sent a message to the new US President Joe Biden.
If Biden has the courage, and I think he does, they should make an announcement that this war is over. They stop the support of the Saudis and the Emiratis and any other people involved, and the war will stop. And Mr. Biden, maybe later on, will get the Nobel Prize that Trump was running after. Now Biden should run after it.
It's been reported that Biden's foreign policy team disagrees with the terror designation and that many of Trump's policies will be reversed in quick succession. But even if the US ends its support for the Saudi coalition's aggression, peace may be unachievable so long as the Ansarullah-held areas are sanctioned. Robert Carter, London.
French President Emmanuel Macron has ruled out issuing an official apology for the atrocities committed by French troops in Algeria. In a statement, Macron's office said there will be no repentance or apologies for the occupation of Algeria or the deadly eight-year war that ended 132 years of French rule in the North African country. Algeria has been demanding a formal apology for years for France's colonial-era war crimes. The French presidency, however, said France will instead endeavor to face up to its history. The statement comes ahead of the publication of a major government commission report on how France has dealt with its colonial past in the North African country. The report offers proposal to address long-standing grievances, but it skirts the issue of systematic torture by French troops and does not recommend an official apology. France occupied Algeria in 1830. The African country gained independence following the Algerian War of 1954 to 1962. The war is also known as the Algerian Revolution. Algerian historians put the death toll at 1.5 million Algerian victims, while the French historians say around 400,000 people from both sides were killed in the conflict. The truth of the colonization and the War of Independence lay buried for decades. During his presidential campaign in 2017, Macron called the colonization of Algeria a crime against humanity. In September 2018, he officially acknowledged for the first time the widespread use of torture by French forces in the former colony. However, like his predecessors, Macron has so far refrained from issuing a formal apology for his country's colonial past. But grievances tied to the colonial history have weighed on French national integration, since many French citizens are Muslims of Algerian descent. As former Foreign Minister Bernard Kouchner admitted in 2008, there seems to be a permanent contradiction between human rights and the foreign policy of France. The country's dark history of human rights violations and supporting dictators, especially in Africa and West Asia, serves as proof of Kouchner's remark that the French foreign policy is not based on human rights. France's support for former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein during his invasion of Iran in the 1980s, its support for Libya's longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi before his ouster in 2011, and the country's arms sales to Saudi Arabia while the kingdom is involved in the brutal war in Yemen are all indicative of such a policy. It so appears that human rights is only a weapon in the hands of French politicians to target nations that do not get along with their policies.
Democrat Joe Biden has been inaugurated as President of the United States, replacing the highly controversial Donald Trump. As a result of entrenched but minority perceptions of electoral fraud, there was not a peaceful transfer of power. The nation's capital was locked down into a fortress with more soldiers than the U.S. uses to occupy both Afghanistan and Iraq. State capitals were similarly swarming with troops nationwide. The inauguration is being called a merciful conclusion to an electoral campaign which seemingly started the day after the election of Trump in 2016, and then the most divisive vote in recent memory. Biden's inaugural speech spoke often of unity and reconciliation, but Democrats and Republicans seem to have been at each other's throats for four consecutive years, how to turn off this mutual animosity may be the most urgent problem Biden faces, but it may also be the most difficult.
47 years of Biden's being in politics, that he would actually be able to do what's necessary to heal the country. Unless, of course, there's some shift in how he sees it, and unless, of course, there's pressure from the left, like I said, the role of labor, to actually improve the quality of life of working people.
Biden inherits an America which may be at its lowest point in history. America in 2020 combines 1930s economic depression, 1960s cultural division, 1860s concerns with white supremacy, and 1780s questions of political legitimacy. The coronavirus is killing Americans faster than ever. A highly divisive Senate trial of the recently impeached Trump looms. Gun sales and murder records were recently recorded nationwide, and the country remains on high alert for acts of political terrorism, to name a few of the worst problems.
If we're not talking about enacting changes that could improve the quality of life immediately, materially, for working people, then I don't think that they'll be able to heal. And I'm talking about, like, Biden is talking about a return to normal. Well, what's normal?
Both Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris are considered to be on the right wing of the Democratic Party. Biden's cabinet is filled with holdovers from the era of Barack Obama, during which Biden was the vice president. Kamala Harris has become the highest-ranking woman ever in American history. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Ansarullah Political Bureau has issued a statement to condemn the U.S. designation of the movement as a terrorist group. The statement was issued after the measure came into effect on January 19th, the last day of President Donald Trump in the office. In its statement, the movement has underlined the atrocity of the U.S. against the nations resisting its adventurist policies, including Yemen. The statement says the blacklisting of Ansarullah movement reveals that the U.S. plays a key role in Saudi-imposed war against Yemen. It calls the U.S. the major enemy of the Yemeni nation.
The American decision and designation was not surprising to us, as it came at the culmination of the U.S. hostilities against the Yemenis, ongoing on for 6 years by two succeeding American administrations. The American administration is the one who is committing acts of terrorism against the Yemenis, and if it reflects negatively on the Yemeni people, there will certainly be a response determined by the leadership.
The U.S. move has also sparked rage among the Yemeni academics and students, who voiced their anger in a protest organized by Sa'a University. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations. The protesters denounced the U.S. policies and its continuing crimes against nations who have not bowed to Washington's desires.
The Yemeni people of all groups, especially the academics, stand against this classification and they stand with Ansarullah. The blacklisting will not harm Ansarullah as it did not harm Hezbollah and all other free people in the world. Rather, it may harm ordinary Yemenis only. We reject this decision and refuse to call the Ansarullah movement a terrorist group.
Yemenis are concerned that the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement may impact the humanitarian situation in Yemen amid the ongoing war that was launched by the Saudi-led coalition in March 2015. The devastating war has so far killed tens of thousands of civilians and injured thousands of others in Yemen, while displacing millions in the country.
Yemenis say the U.S. blacklisting of the Ansarullah movement is an unacceptable move, prompted by the Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. They say the move is aimed at putting more pressure on Yemen, already in dire situation from war and the blockade imposed by the U.S.-backed Saudi-led coalition. Abdulatif al-Washali, Sana'a.
In July 2020, following the enforcement of new national security laws on Hong Kong by China, the UK announced plans to expand visa rights to Hong Kong residents who claimed British National Overseas or BNO status before Britain handed over its former colony in 1997. Until recently, BNO passports did not give Hong Kong citizens the right of residence in the UK, but Number 10 has now changed the rules.
We made clear, Mr. Speaker, that if China continued down this path, we would reintroduce a new route for those with British national overseas status to enter the UK, granting them limited leave to remain, with the ability to live and work in the UK and thereafter to apply for citizenship. And that is precisely what we will do now.
China and Hong Kong both say this violates the Sino-British Declaration that paves the way for Hong Kong to return to Chinese rule. Hong Kong leader Carrie Lam says the BNO is a form of travel document, not a form of nationality.
If one side, and that is the UK government, tries to deviate from that mutual understanding and bilateral agreement, then of course it's legitimate for the other side, that is the Central People's Government, to consider any countermeasures. And the Hong Kong SAR government will, of course, support any countermeasures to be adopted by the Central People's Government.
UK-China relations deteriorated in 2020. The UK banned Chinese telecom giant Huawei from the build-out of the UK's 5G network. It put forward a proposal to screen and block certain mergers and acquisitions from Chinese investors on national security grounds. And as a former colonial power decided to throw its weight around, declaring China's national security laws on Hong Kong to be a breach of the Sino-British Joint Declaration. On this pretext, Number 10 is offering almost three quarters of Hong Kong's population a fast-track route to British citizenship, stoking fears of brain drain in the city, especially in its healthcare system. England alone has around 50,000 vacancies for registered nurses, and the COVID-19 pandemic has thrown the NHS's staffing crisis into stark relief. Brexit has made sourcing health professionals from Europe much more difficult, and strict immigration policies also make recruitment from abroad very challenging. Bianca Rahimi, London.
The ground forces of Iran's army kicked off war games along the Makran coasts of the Sea of Oman, southeast of Iran. The drills called Iqtedar or Power 99 started with the participation of airborne units, special forces, and quick reaction units. The troops received logistical and combat support from the Air Force and the Army Ground Forces Airborne Division at the coastal zones in Hormozgan province. A combination of homegrown and creative military tactics was practiced in the offense exercise based on the new structure of the ground forces.
The main purpose of the war game is to evaluate the mobility and defense power of the Rapid Reaction Forces and Corps and the mobile defense units of the Army Ground Forces. They also practice rapid and decisive response to threats on the hypothetical enemy's coasts.
We talked to Iran's Army Commander Major General Abdulrahim Mousavi, who attended the drills, asking him if the extensive war games are in reaction to U.S. deployment of forces to the region in recent weeks.
It seems that the Americans are somehow confused and are suffering from indecisiveness. This is the first time in the U.S. history that they are in a very inappropriate condition. Our drills are generally preemptive, but as they may make some insane moves, we stage these maneuvers to say we are ready against any calculation error by the adversaries.
We also talked to the war games commanders, who gave more details regarding the drills on the land and at the sea.
Our parachuters descended from planes and then got on armored personnel carriers to approach the mock enemy targets and destroy them. In another part of the exercise, some special forces and divers will descend from choppers on the sea surface to get to the beach and fight mock enemy forces.
The Iranian military forces have held several massive maneuvers over the past few weeks. The importance of this year's drills conducted by the Army's forces relies on the native nature of the equipment used in the event. Almost all of the equipment used in the war games this year are homegrown. Human Abedi,
Jost.
Amid the